Danke sehr. Wie es in der Mathematik keinen besonderen Königsweg gibt, so lassen sich auch die Einsichten in gewisse Grundfragen der Physik nicht ohne Kenntnis bestimmter naturwissenschaftlicher Tatsachen, nicht ohne Zuhilfenahme der Mittel der höheren Mathematik klar gewinnen.
Albert, my dear friend, we are sitting here in beautiful Williams Bay, Wisconsin, so please try to speak to all of us, if you would be so kind, in English.
Edwin, you are so right. I do apologize to our audience here in this beautiful library and to our listening audience on WGTD Public Radio. Allow me to begin once again, this time in English.
Albert, we are almost appreciative.
From the beginning, it shall be. There is no special silver bullet in mathematics, and also the insights into certain basic questions of physics cannot be clearly won without any knowledge of certain scientific facts and without the help of the means of higher mathematics. The visible realities are the microscope and the telescope. However, the invisible realities are in a certain way the differential and integral calculus. If you want to or must renounce these means, you cannot sufficiently explain, but only point out suggestively.
Albert, you know, it was only 1 year before I completed my dissertation at the University of Chicago, with much of my time spent here at Yerkes, that you published your theory of relativity.
Yes, it was 1916, and I sought to explain situations in which Newtonian physics might fail to deal successfully with phenomena, and in so doing proposed revolutionary changes in human concepts of time, space and gravity.
Yes, and then you said that the special theory of relativity was based on two main postulates. First, that the speed of light is constant for all observers, and second, that observers moving at constant speeds should be subject to the same physical laws.
But Edwin, allow me to take a moment to acquaint our audience with your dissertation topic, which was and still is quite remarkable. Even the title is scientifically wonderful. Photographic investigations of the faint nebulae. I've been wanting to ask you, why did you select this title?
I began my dissertation by summarizing the state of knowledge of nebulae in 1917 by stating, extremely little is known of the nature of nebulae and no significant classification has yet been suggested. Not even a precise definition has been formulated. The essential features are that they are situated outside our solar system, that they present sensible surfaces, and that they should be unresolved into separate stars.
Excuse me?
How can we assist you, young man?
Sorry to interrupt you, but I was standing at the doorway to the library and overheard you talking about our solar system and beyond. And I have a question.
Well, well, Albert, we have an inquisitive young mind here. How do you think we should proceed?
Before we proceed in answering such a question, let me first ask Robert a most defining question.
Me? A question? Okay.
This is where I leave the intellectual experiment solely up to you, Albert.
Let me start by saying to you, Master Robert, the important thing is not to stop questioning and never lose your curiosity. Never.
Dr. Einstein, I am always asking questions at my school and at home, to my teachers and to my parents. I do think they're getting quite weary of my questions.
Robert, first of all, I ask you to kindly call me Albert. And secondly, I urge you to never tire of asking questions.
Yes, Dr. Albert, I never will.
And now, what question, Albert, do you have for Robert?
Robert, why is the question more important than the answer?
That is an interesting question, Albert. Here's what I think. It's the questions we can't answer that teach us the most. They teach us how to think. If you give a person an answer, all they gain is a little fact. But give them a question and then look for their own answers.
It's a funny thing, Robert. People are sometimes afraid to ask questions out of fear of seeming stupid. And yet, some of the smartest people on the planet are often the ones who ask the most questions.
So, Robert, what do you think about what Albert just said?
Dr. Hubble, I spend almost every weekend here at Yerkes, and I'm never afraid to ask questions. That's why I come here.
Robert, that's wonderful.
Dr. Hubble, I'd rather ask you a question, one that you yourself asked back in the early 1900s.
Go on, Robert, ask away.
In the early 1900s, astronomers like you and others were debating the makeup of all those cloudy spiral-shaped objects found throughout the night sky. And people were asking, were they gas clouds located within our own Milky Way galaxy? Or were they vast groups of stars located far beyond our galaxy?
You mean the spiral nebulae, don't you, Robert?
Yes, that's exactly what I mean. But Dr. Hubble, I'm still confused.
You confused? With your bright, inquisitive mind? So, Robert, what confuses you?
Yes, Robert. Tell both of us.
Okay, here's the rub. Here's what I don't understand. Both of you have talked and written about extragalactic astronomy. I know that it's a branch of astronomy concerned with objects outside the Milky Way galaxy. In other words, it's the study of all astronomical objects which are not covered by galactic astronomy. Am I correct in this assumption, Dr. Hubble?
Go on, Edwin. Explain this phenomenon to the robot. I want to hear this myself.
Robert, yes, you are correct. Galactic astronomy is the study of our own Milky Way, while extragalactic astronomy is the study of other galaxies. Our sun is merely one of hundreds of billions of stars in the galaxy, and our galaxy is but one of hundreds of billions of galaxies in the observable universe.
Yes, I understand that. But how do all of these systems of stars, gas, and dark matter form and evolve in time?
They just do. That's the beauty of our scientific world. That's why studying astronomy here at Yerkes is a perfect place for you, Robert.
And the nebulae?
Robert, allow me to respond if you don't mind.
Dr. Einstein, of course not. Please do.
Well, Robert, one of the biggest unsolved problems in early 20th century astronomy was the question of what were nebulae. These gaseous fuzzy clouds were thought by some astronomers to be embryonic solar systems forming, while others thought that they were island universes, like our own Milky Way galaxy. The advent of spectroscopy and photography in the late 19th century, when used on the latest generation of large reflecting telescopes in the early 20th century, provided astronomers with all of the right tools to study these objects.
Even during a total solar eclipse?
What? A total solar eclipse?
Albert, that sounds like a perfect lead into having Sir Arthur join us.
I agree with you 100%. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Sir Arthur Eddington, one of the most prominent English astrophysicists of the early 20th century.
Thank you, Albert. It's always very special for me to be here at Yerkes Observatory here in Williams Bay.
And when did we last have a chance to chat, Sir Arthur?
Albert, it must have been when you and I were lecturing together at Princeton University back in 1936. Alan Turing, the earliest computer whiz kid, was there, if you recall.
Oh, I do, actually.
Sir Arthur, I was just reading one of your papers that you wrote back in June of 1919, just after that eventful day on May 29th of the same year.
It was a relatively important day, as I recall.
I have always enjoyed your sense of humor, Arthur.
Thank you, Albert. For it was on that day in May of 1919, during a total solar eclipse, that I performed the first experimental test of your general theory of relativity.
Robert, do you recall exactly what Sir Arthur did on that day?
Yes, of course I do.
Robert, please explain to our audience here in the library at Yerkes and those listening on their radio sets at home.
Well, just a little bit of background first. In 1919, Newton's law of universal gravity still dominated the academic and scientific world, as it provided extremely accurate explanations of physical observations. But Dr. Einstein had a major issue with my Sir Isaac Newton's theory. It wasn't constant with his own special theory of relativity, which predicted that space and time were relative, forming a four-dimensional continuum called space-time. He conceived a general theory of relativity in which gravitational fields would cause warps in space-time, thus weaving gravity into the continuum.
You are quite correct, Robert.
In fact, Robert, one prediction of general relativity was that light should not travel in a perfectly straight line while traveling through space-time and nearing the warp induced by an object's gravitational field. Light should curve, but not by much.
Sir Eddington, where did you actually go to observe that solar eclipse?
I went to the remote island of Principe, which is in the Gulf of Guinea off the west coast of Africa, to measure the stars' positions during the eclipse as viewed through the sun's gravitational lens.
That's fascinating. I just looked up more about your trip here on my iPad. It says, both locations had clear skies, and astronomers took several pictures during the 6 minutes of total eclipse. And when you returned to England, your data from Principe confirmed Dr. Einstein's predictions.
Albert, everyone today in 2016, and even long before this date, loves to quote you, especially anything to do with E equals MC squared.
Of course! Energy equals mass times the speed of light squared. On the most basic level, the equation says that energy and mass are interchangeable. They are different forms of the same thing. Under the right conditions, energy can become mass, and vice versa. We humans don't see them that way. How can a beam of light and, say, a walnut, be different forms of the same thing? But nature does.
Yes. Now, of all those quotations that people love to attribute to me, believing that my general theory of relativity was too beautiful to be wrong, I did come up with one of my most frequently quoted opinions to a reporter. He asked me what I would have done had the eclipse experiment not agreed with relativity, and I told him, then I would feel sorry for the good Lord. The theory is correct.
Albert, no one feels sorry for our Lord because your theory is correct.
Albert, your basic theory remains our best and most reliable window into the nature of gravity, space-time, and the very nature of our universe. Black holes would not be possible to describe without that theory of yours.
Dr. Einstein, if I may also add my thoughts to this discussion.
Go on, Robert.
Gravity waves are being strenuously sought as a last test of your quite elegant theory. Even the cosmical constant that you added to those equations to describe the evolution of the universe has now found its mirrors in the vast sea of dark energy that permeates our cosmos.
Now those were glorious days, Robert.
But, of course, no fundamental discovery is without its controversies. As we all know, Albert, some physicists at that time were not convinced by the poor quality of data taken during the eclipse that your theory had indeed been confirmed.
Heisenberg!
Robert, what about Werner Heisenberg?
I think that one of the weirdest aspects of quantum theory is that it is impossible to know certain things, such as the particle's momentum and position, simultaneously. Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. Yeah, that's the one that comes to mind right away. No kidding.
I agree. Werner Heisenberg was a brilliant man, even though he was thrust into Hitler's horrible war efforts during World War II.
But didn't he knowingly get involved in the whole heavy water research project and the Nazis' attempt to create an atomic bomb?
Yes, Robert, he did know what he was doing. But his uncertainty principle was brilliant, if I may say so.
Yes, it was.
The uncertainty principle. The position and momentum of a particle cannot be simultaneously measured with arbitrarily high precision. There is a minimum for the product of the uncertainties of these two measurements. There is likewise a minimum for the product of the uncertainties of the energy and time.
Robert, can you say in plain English, in its simplest terms, what Professor Einstein just said?
Yes, I believe I can. Absolutely.
Robert,
by all means, let us tell us.
Imagine that you're blind, and over time you've developed a technique for determining how far away an object is by throwing a heavy medicine ball at it. If you throw your medicine ball at a nearby stool, the ball will return quickly, and you'll know that it's close. If you throw a ball at something across the street from you, it'll take longer to return, and you know that the object is far away. The problem is that when you throw a ball, especially a heavy one like a medicine ball, at something like a stool, the ball will knock the stool across the room and may not even have enough momentum to bounce back.
I see.
And as I was saying, you can say where the stool was, but not where it is now. What's more, you can calculate the velocity of the stool after you hit it with the ball, but you have no idea what its velocity was before you hit it.
That is very astute of you, Robert. Well stated and quite well thought out.
Thank you, Sir Eddington.
Albert, tell me, when did you first visit the Yerkes Observatory in Williams Bay?
It was Friday, May the 6th, back in 1921.
What was the weather like that day, Dr. Einstein?
Oh, it was quite nice. Upper 70s, I do believe.
Professor Einstein, what is that noise?
I was just going to ask Dr. Hubble the same thing. Edwin, what is going on?
I think that the telescope platform is moving around. Someone must be using the big 40-incher.
Who's up there?
I think it might be Professor Angela Oliveira from the University of Chicago. I was told she might be here this morning.
Ah, yes, Dr. Oliveira. I read her latest research article on the measurement of radiation energy in the radio signals of extensive air showers as a universal estimator of cosmic ray energy. Oh, it was fascinating.
I must read it. But first, I think she is giving a lecture on black holes in space. Let's poke our heads in and listen for a moment.
We must always remember that the collapse to black holes has been related to gigantic explosions from deep space that produces bursts of gamma rays, first detected by a defense satellite in the 1960s that was designed to check for Soviet nuclear tests.
I must ask the professor a question.
Must you interrupt her, Albert?
Edwin, please. She knows who I am and would not be put off just by one little question.
If you say so.
Excuse me, Dr. Oliveira.
Yes? Who was asking? Why, everyone, look, it's Dr. Albert Einstein.
No applause, please. That was very nice of all of you, but totally unnecessary.
Oh, Dr. Einstein, it is a pleasure to welcome you back here at Yerkes. Oh, it has been some time.
Yes, you are correct. Actually, it was May of 1921.
Well, as I said, it has been a long time.
Dr. Oliveira, I know that your primary areas of academic research are in theoretical astrophysics, particle and nuclear astrophysics, and cosmology. But I'm particularly interested in your work on energy cosmic rays, indirect signatures of particle dark matter, and the internal structure of neutron stars.
Really? And why is that, Professor Einstein?
In reading your research, I always seem to come back to your cosmological and astronomical studies, which shows that over the last decades is that most of the energy density of the universe is of an unknown type. About 70% of the total energy budget is in the form of so-called dark energy, while 26% is comprised of dark matter, which has no significant interactions with light, neither through emission nor absorption.
And if I may add this comment, Dr. Oliveira, the ordinary baryonic matter that we and the world of our immediate experience are made of makes up a mere 4% of the total energy content of the universe.
That is all quite true. But then, let me say this.
Excuse me, Professor Oliveira, but what about Professor Zwicky's study about the Doppler effect and the coma cluster?
And you are?
Sorry, I forgot to introduce myself. My name is Robert Gillian. I attend the High School Academy for Math and Science in Madison.
Now, Robert, a discrepancy between the amounts of visible matter and gravitationally interacting matter, both in the Milky Way and in the galaxy clusters, was first noticed in the early 1930s. Almost at the same time, Zwicky inferred in 1933 from the Doppler shift studies of the velocity dispersion of galaxies in the coma cluster that the total mass of the clusters must vastly exceed the luminous mass. He did this by using well-established mass-to-light ratios to estimate the luminous cluster mass and then applying the Virial theorem to estimate the gravitationally interacting mass from the measured velocity dispersion.
Dr. Oliveira, we just studied the Virial theorem, and I even put it to the test.
Oh, really? Tell me some more, Robert.
Well, the Virial theorem states that for a stable self-gravitating spherical distribution of equal mass objects, like stars and galaxies, that the total kinetic energy of the objects is equal to minus 1/2 times the total gravitational potential energy. In other words, the potential energy must be equal the kinetic energy within a factor of 2.
I think I'd better jump in on this discussion if that's okay with you, Robert.
Well, that's fine with me, Albert. Professor Einstein.
Oh, but you can call me Albert. It's perfectly fine with me.
I do appreciate your generosity, but I shall call you Professor Einstein. It does seem so much more proper anyway.
That's fine, Robert.
Good. As you were saying, Professor?
I always found the Virial Theorem to be a bit magical. It seems surprising at first that such a simple law could hold so generally. But in fact, the Virial Theorem also applies to forces other than gravity and impacts everything from astronomy to the theory of gases. For example, out in space, very often a bunch of particles will collapse to form a gravitationally bound system. If the system is roughly in equilibrium, so the time averages of kinetic and potential energy are close to their current values. This is a terrific thing, because it lets you find the masses of bound systems. In fact, it's really the reason we think that dark matter exists.
Dr. Oliveira, I do have one other question about the Virial Theorem.
Yes?
How does the Virial Theorem interact with stars? The galaxies?
Interesting question, Robert. Now, I don't want to get too far into the cosmic weeds for you or for our audience. Let me try to explain it this way. Modern evidence for dark matters comes primarily from cosmology in the form of observations of the large-scale structure of the universe, distant supernova, and the temperature anisotropies of the cosmic microwave background, as well as from the synthesis of primordial elements.
I see.
Robert, if I may jump in, as long as we are not too far into the cosmic weeds, as Dr. Oliveira called them.
Of course, Dr. Hubble. I love being engulfed by the cosmic weeds.
As do I. The Big Bang nucleosynthesis theory predicts that roughly 25% of the mass of the universe consists of helium. It also predicts about 0.001% deuterium and even smaller quantities of lithium. The important point is that the prediction depends critically on the density of baryons, for example, neutrons and protons, at the time of nucleosynthesis. In terms of present-day critical density of matter, the required density of baryons is a few percent, and the exact value depends on the assumed value of the Hubble constant.
Edwin, your constant, the Hubble constant, has always fascinated me.
Why is that, Sir Arthur?
Because in the late 1920s, you discovered that the universe is expanding, with galaxies moving away from each other at a velocity given by an expression known as Hubble's law. This is where V equals H times R. Here, V represents the galaxy's recession of velocity, R is its distance away from Earth, and H is a constant of proportionality called Hubble's constant.
That is quite true. In fact, on very large scales, Professor Einstein's theory predicts departures from a strictly linear Hubble law. The amount of departure and the type depends on the amount of types of mass and energy of the universe.
As we stand here in the Yerkes Observatory, I am struck by the vastness of not only this magnificent structure, but of space itself.
Albert, I agree, 100%.
Edwin, one of the unsolved problems in early 20th century astronomy was the question of what were nebulae?
That is very true. That's why I used the 100-inch Hooker telescope on Mount Wilson in California, which was then the largest telescope in the world, to study the Andromeda Nebula M31. It was back in 1923 that I identified some of the stars within it as Cepheid variables. These are periodic variable stars, that is, stars that vary their brightness in a regular way.
So where are we now? From where have we come? And where are we going? Those are the important questions to ask.
Professor Einstein, since I am a person who is here still being trained to ask the right questions, let me flip the table, if I may do so.
Oh, absolutely, Robert. This moving platform is all yours.
Thank you. A convincing theoretical interpretation of these questions, I believe, can be found with the adoption of Einstein's general theory of relativity, which is a radically new conception of how gravity manifests itself and an effect of the behavior of space-time. The space that seemed to separate galaxies from one another has now seemed to bind them together. Hubble's law then emerges from this picture as a natural consequence, an expanding universe, considered not as a collection of galaxies moving through static space, but embedded in a space which is itself evolving dynamically.
Sir Arthur, what do you think about how Robot has synthesized our discussion of the universe into such a neat little package?
I am impressed. He was quite thorough. I will add one piece to his well-formulated space
project.
Please
do.
Thank you, Albert. At present, there is no theory that can fully account for the existence of vacuum energy. But it is possible that it might eventually be explained by the behavior of quantum fields that arise in the theory of elementary particles. This could lead to a unified description of the inner space of subatomic matter and the outer space of general relativity, which has been the goal of many physicists for a considerable time. That would be a spectacular achievement, but, as with everything else in science, it will only work if we have the correct conceptual framework.
Sir Arthur, that is so true, and that's why it's so important we make sure that students of today, like Robert, are constantly engaged in the science of space. Don't you agree, Albert?
Oh, yes, I completely agree with you.
Let me say this. At the Yerkes Observatory, they carry out a research program of looking at how stars have moved over the past century. It has a vast collection of photographic plates showing star locations to high precision, making it possible to do comparisons from the early 1900s. This work is also helping to calibrate the Sloan Digital Sky Survey.
I cannot stay quiet when it comes to the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, or the SDSS.
Angela, I figure the moment SDSS was mentioned, you would want to elaborate.
Dr. Hubble, it's a project that has captured the minds, hearts, and spirits of thousands of scientists from all over the world.
Oh, do tell us more, Dr. Oliveira.
Ah, Professor Einstein, the Sloan Digital Sky Survey has been working for more than 15 years to make a map of the universe and will continue for many years to come. Sir Isaac Newton would have been proud of the SDSS.
Dr. Oliveira, I would agree with you. Sir Isaac Newton would have been quite impressed with the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. You know, for the millennia, humans have wondered about the universe outside of our world. The stars and the planets, which are mere points of light in the night sky, have always piqued our curiosity as we sought to understand our place in the cosmos.
Yes, that is very true, Robert. You know, you do seem so advanced for your young age. To the ancients, these points of light were often viewed in connection with higher powers beyond their control, such as gods and goddesses. Some civilizations began to realize that certain celestial events repeated at regular intervals.
And many of those civilizations used these regular events to mark time, helping with agriculture and religious observances.
Yes.
Later, sky charts, produced with the naked eye observations, became essential tools for navigation and trade.
Albert, I think our degree of intelligence on such space matters have been literally circumvented twice over by Robert.
It would seem that way, Edwin. And why no one has even bothered to ask you about the remarkable Hubble telescope that continues to peer into distant black holes of space, even as we speak, is beyond even myself.
This orbit is quite remarkable.
Dr. Hubble, I have been quite anxious to ask you many questions about the HST, or should I say, the Hubble Space Telescope.
Ask away, Robert.
I know that the Hubble satellite orbits the Earth at an altitude of about 353 miles, and it takes about 97 minutes to complete one orbit around the Earth. It also passes into the shadow of the Earth for 28 to 36 minutes in each orbit. But I still wonder about gravity.
Why does that concern you?
Edwin, I do think that Robert is about to make a very important point.
Professor Einstein, when you were formulating your groundbreaking theory of relativity, or gravity, in the early 20th century, at a time when astronomers only really knew of the existence of our own galaxy, you necessarily used the simplifying assumption that the universe has the same gross properties in all parts, and that it looks roughly the same in every direction, wherever in the universe an observer happens to be located. Just when I made the assumption 200 years before, Professor Einstein also assumed an infinite static or steady state universe when its stars suspendedly ascended, essentially motionless in a vast void.
Oh, allow me to interject this. When Professor Einstein tried to apply his general theory of relativity to the universe as a whole, he realized that space-time as a whole must be warped and curved back on itself, which would in itself cause matter to move, shrinking uncontrollably under its own gravity. Then, as early as 1917, you, Professor Einstein, and others realized that the equations of general relativity did not describe a static universe.
Yeah, that is quite true, Professor Oliveira. But before we continue with this delicious academic exercise, I would like to rewind part of this discussion back to you. Robert?
Me? And why is that, Professor Einstein?
Let me ask you a few questions, since I know you love asking and answering questions.
Yes, you are quite correct.
I saw in your book bag some books about optics and light by such English physicists as Robert Boyle and Robert Hooke. Am I correct?
Yes, I have read many books. Theirs are just a sampling of what I have read.
And I also noted several academic papers and abstracts written on the topics of mathematics and the physics by the French philosopher and scientist René Descartes.
Yes, correct again,
and
Professor.
And then in Paris in 1675, Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz independently evolved the first ideas of his differential calculus, outlined by you. Sir Isaac Newton, back in 1677. I do believe that you had already described some of your mathematical discoveries to Leibniz, not including his method of fluxions.
That is correct.
Sir Arthur, I do believe that you have something quite important to add. Something about an apple, I believe?
Yes, Robert, you are correct. According to the well-known story, it was once seeing an apple fall from your orchard, Sir Isaac, at some time during 1665 or 1666, that you conceived that the same force governed the motion of the moon in the apple.
I do believe I know exactly where this conversation is going. You are all correct. Spot on, actually. It was at that time when the apple dropped from the tree in my orchard that I calculated the force needed to hold the moon in its orbit as compared with force pulling an object to the ground. I also calculated the centripetal force needed to hold a stone in a sling and the relation between the length of a pendulum and the time of its swing.
Robert, you are actually Sir Isaac Newton, and it is 2016.
I confess, I am guilty of this charade. I am Sir Isaac Newton.
This is quite fascinating. Actually, amazing. So, Sir Isaac, is it true that your correspondence with the English physicist Robert Hooke redirected you to the problem of the path of a body subjected to a centrally directed force that varies as the inverse square of the distance?
Yes, that is true. I determined it all by an ellipse, and I have informed Edmund Halley in August 1684. Halley's interest led me to demonstrate the relationship once again, and then compose a brief tract of mechanics, and finally to write the Principia, all three books. Mm-hmm.
And it is in book number 3 that you show the law of gravitation at work in the universe. You demonstrate it from the revolutions of the 6 known planets, including the Earth and their satellites.
However, Sir Isaac, you could never quite perfect the difficult theory of the moon's motion. That always surprised me. But yet, comets were shown to obey the same law. In later editions, you continued to add conjecture on the possibility of their return.
Sir Isaac then calculated the relative masses of heavenly bodies from their gravitational forces and the oblateness of Earth and Jupiter already observed. And then you explained the tidal ebb and flow and the precession of the equinoxes from the forces exerted by the sun and moon. All this was done by exact computation.
Sir Arthur, I always had to make sure my calculations were exact. If I didn't, people would think that a whole orchard of apples, and not just one, as the story goes, had fallen on my head all at once.
Gentlemen, as we near the end of this story that has whipsawed all around the universe, through what has obviously been many time periods. How does this whole story now come together?
Dr. Oliveira, are you suggesting that the story must actually come to an end? We were just beginning to have such glorious fun.
Alas, unfortunately, Professor Einstein, time is fleeting in more ways than I would ever try to imagine.
Yeah, I understand completely. So you ask, how does this whole story we have been weaving come together?
Yes.
To a logical ending.
Yes, that is my question.
Dr. Oliveira, please let me begin.
Oh, Dr. Hubble, please. The platform is yours.
For Professor Einstein, Sir Isaac Newton's space was only a crude approximation to a larger reality.
Yeah.
Einstein's theory proposed no less a magical thing than what we call space is really a piece of larger fabric called space-time. The geometry of space-time can be curved and warped in the presence of matter and even pure energy, like light itself.
Sir Isaac, I think this is where you and I are expected to jump into this conversation.
My first law of motion states that objects continue to move in a state of constant velocity, which can be zero, unless acted upon by an external force.
Mm-hmm.
The tendency of an object to resist a change in motion is known as inertia.
Dunno. Sir Isaac, can you put that first law into its simplest form so that we can all understand?
Of course I can. This was actually written by a fifth grade student at a school up near Bayfield, Wisconsin. She says this: the first law says that an object at rest tends to stay at rest. And if an object in motion tends to stay in motion with the same direction and speed.
Phew.
Let me add this. Mm-hmm. Motion or lack of motion cannot change without an unbalanced force acting. If nothing is happening to you and nothing goes on happening, you will never go anywhere.
No.
And if you're going in a specific direction, unless something happens to you, you will always go in that direction, forever.
Uh-huh. Sir Isaac, that is absolutely the most concise explanation of your first law that I have ever heard.
Thank you, Edwin. And now, before we say goodbye to everyone here today, and those listening over the airwaves, and through the global and certainly the interstellar internet, let me ask Professor Einstein to reward us all with his very own simplistic explanation of his famous equation.
Oh, Sir Isaac, that would be the only way we could truly end this scientific saga here today.
I would be honored to do so. The easiest way to make E equals MC squared understandable to children is to start with a paraphrase of the first law of thermodynamics. Nothing disappears. Everything goes somewhere.
And thank you, Professor Einstein. And this has been Einstein and Hubble, Lost Somewhere in Space. This original radio drama was written by Mike Ostrup and myself, Steve Brown, and our director was Vicky Dumay. Our stars from the 91.1 players were Siegfried Christoph as Dr. Albert Einstein, Andrew Potter as Edwin Hubble, Cameron Spencer as Sir Arthur Eddington, Benjamin Abrahamson as Robert Gillian, or should I say Sir Isaac Newton, and Vicky Dumay, who is Professor Angela Oliveira. And before I tell you about our next shows, and also a bit about the Yerkes Observatory, let me remind you that support for the WGTD Radio Theater comes from the Kenosha Law Firm of Aaliyah Dumay and McTernan, and the not-for-profit Brown Ostrich Performing Arts Foundation located in Salem, Wisconsin. Just a bit of information about our next shows, by the way. Our next show will be October 8th, and that will be at Lake Lawn Resort in Delavan. And this will be a comedy show with Fibber McGee and Molly, Our Miss Brooks, and It's the Professor. And this will be a campaign election episode. Then October 21st, the Brown Ostrich Performing Arts Foundation will be performing the Cedar Chest Letters, written by Barb Tyler, one of our founding members of the 91.1 Players and one of our directors. Her play will be performed in Oshkosh at the Time Community Center in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. And this will be on WRST Public Radio. On November 5th, the WGTD Radio Theater will perform The Cane Shadow. And The Cane Shadow returns, and this will be at Lake Lawn Resort. And then our holiday show, Andy Hardy Puts on a Show, and that'll be at Lake Lawn Resort on December 10th. And before we wrap things up, let me give you a bit of information about the Yerkes Observatory. It's a facility of the Department of Astronomy and Astrophysics at the University of Chicago. It was established back in 1897 on Geneva Lake in Williams Bay, Wisconsin. And until the mid-1960s, Yerkes Observatory housed all of the department's activities. And today, the 77-acre park-like site in southeast Wisconsin provides laboratory space and access to telescopes for research and instruction. And also, it occupies a unique niche for the educational and scientific community. And on Education Matters today, before this show aired, the radio theater, we aired information and stories about the summer camp that's taking place there at Yerkes. Also, there's a wide range of opportunities and learning at Yerkes. And if you want more information, you can go directly to their website at Yerkes Observatory, and that's at astro.uchicago.edu. For the WGTD Radio Theater and the 91.1 Players, I'm Steve Brown. Thank you so much for listening to the WGTD Radio Theater, where we have just performed Einstein and Hubble, Lost Somewhere in Space.